often every day. Never forget to say La ilaha illa Allah.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The Australian government announces a plan to blacklist the whole of Palestinian resistance movement Hamas. The country had previously designated Hamas's military wing, the Al-Qassam Brigades, back in 2003. Under the new restrictions, which will go into force in April, financing or providing any support to Hamas will be criminalized, with some offenses carrying a 25-year prison sentence. The reason for the blacklisting is what Canberra calls the group's, quote, hateful ideologies. But let's dive deeper and learn more about the Gaza-based group. Ever since Hamas scored a landslide victory in Gaza's parliamentary elections in 2006, it has been running the besieged enclave. Protecting the Strip has been one of the group's core responsibilities. Over the years, it has carried out the responsibility, the most recent instance of which came in May 2021, during the Israeli military's 11-day war on the Gaza Strip. The war killed some 250 Palestinians, including 66 children, but only 12 Israelis. If it weren't for the deterrent capabilities of the group, the number of Palestinian casualties would have been a lot higher. How would this justify branding the group as a terrorist organization? The case in point is that any group whose ideology goes against that of the U.S. and its allies is hit with such allegations. Hamas spokesman Hazem Qassem condemns Australia's decision to list the movement as a terrorist organization and calls on the Australian government to present an apology to the Palestinian people. He said the planned move attests to the biased support for the occupying regime and emboldens Israel to press ahead with its aggression against Palestinian people. The Islamic Jihad and the Popular Resistance Committees were also among Palestinian groups denouncing the decision. Voices of condemnation also came from inside Australia. The Australia-Palestine Advocacy Network, a national coalition of Australians who support Palestinian rights, disagreed with the designation, saying that it does nothing to advance the cause of peace and will only create more suffering for the 2 million people currently living under the 15-year Israeli blockade.
The word terrorist has been essentially coined and put into circulation by Zionists to demonize the people who are resisting their genocide in Palestine and the people all over the world who support that resistance. And in fact, the actual meaning of the word terrorism is deliberately targeting civilians to create fear or terror. And that is a military tactic that has been used since time immemorial by all sorts of different forces.
All in all, in the absence of any meaningful support for the people of Palestine and the condemnation of Tel Aviv, Israel continues to commit gross violations and gets away with murder.
The MKO terrorist group appears to be expanding its operations to include trafficking, among other criminal activities. An Albanian historian and journalist says the country's police have alerted the U.S. embassy that members of the terrorist organization are involved in various criminal activities in Europe, including human trafficking, with possible links to the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group. Alsi Jazeshi, citing Albanian media reports, says the MKO operatives, headed by the terrorist ringleader Mariam Rajavi, and based in a camp near the capital Tirana, have attempted to traffic over 400 of the group's own members to France. Jazeshi added that a number of the terrorist cult's members have been detained for trafficking people from the Middle East to Europe, who were most likely Daesh terrorists. The journalist also says some senior MKO members, including the ringleader's sister-in-law, have been arrested while trying to traffic drugs into Italy, with police having prosecuted another member over theft charges. The Albanian police deny sending any letter to the American embassy without elaborating further. The journalist says the terror group has forced an Albanian media outlet to take down an article it published about the arrests.
They used Albania as a safe haven to carry out illegal activities and criminal acts. And now they are becoming a problem for Greece, Italy, Germany, and France. And when I say problem, not just trafficking human beings, drugs, money laundering, and some other activities. They have become a problem for Albania for the crimes I just mentioned, but also burglary, pickpocketing, harassing women, sexual harassment, and at least one case of rape.
Critics in Albania blame the United States and its Western allies for providing protection for the terrorist cult. Mujahideen Khalq Organization, MKO, also known as the MEK, is a notorious anti-Iran terror group that embraces an ideology that mixes Marxism and terrorism. MKO's crimes against Iran run the gamut from collaborating with Iraq's former dictator Saddam Hussein during the 1980 to 1988 war on Iran to a violent campaign of bombings across the country. One of the group's highest profile acts of terror came on June 28, 1981, when a powerful bomb went off at the headquarters of an Iranian political party, the Islamic Republican Party, where the party's leaders were holding a meeting. The bombing killed scores of Iranian officials, including the then head of Supreme Judicial Council, Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti. Most recently, Iran said there were traces of MKO involvement in the assassination of Iran's top scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh in November 2020. The anti-Iran organization has long been recognized as a terror group by much of the international community. However, in June 2008, the United Kingdom crossed the group off its terror list. The move was followed by the European Union in 2009 and the United States in 2012. Canada followed in the footsteps of the Western countries in delisting MKO as a terror group in December 2012 without offering any reason for the decision.
Some of them have their hands stained with blood. Some of them have battlefield experience. Some of them have some formal training by Mukhabarat, the special secret police of Saddam Hussein. So they are not just poor people trying to go to Europe to make a living. They are a danger. Criminals need to go to prison, not to roam in the streets of European cities. Absolutely. This is my idea.
Since removing their decade-long ban on the MKO, the Western nations, especially the United States, have used the group as a tool to pressure Iran. But the latest revelations about the terror organization can serve as a wake-up call for its Western supporters that the threats they have been brewing against Iran will backfire on them.
The government of Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is in trouble. His cabinet has invoked a rarely used emergency ordinance to quell anti-vaccine truck protests that have crippled the country. The Emergency Act can authorize the use of the military. It can also temporarily suspend citizens' rights to free movement or assembly, and the government is taking steps to stop financial support of illegal protests. The measure allows Canadian banks to freeze accounts suspected of funding the blockades and suspend insurance on vehicles in the protests. Trudeau has noted that the measures will be time-limited, geographically targeted, as well as reasonable and proportionate. The Canadian law, which was passed in 1988, says, "For the purpose of this act, a national emergency is an urgent and critical situation of a temporary nature that cannot be effectively dealt with under any other law of Canada." Trudeau said, "The government is not overriding the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, nor limiting the right to peaceful assembly."
The federal government has invoked the Emergencies Act to supplement provincial and territorial capacity to address the blockades and occupations.
The plan has drawn widespread condemnation from Canadians, including the Premier in Quebec, Francis Legault, who said Trudeau's announcements risk putting oil on the fire. The trouble all began after thousands of protesters in trucks and other vehicles blocked the streets of Ottawa, as well as two border crossings with the U.S. to vent their frustration over COVID-19 vaccine mandates. The protests have not stayed in Canada, though. Similar freedom convoy protests have grown in countries like the U.S., France, New Zealand, Australia. As common with protests, many have also vented their anger against the government due to their economic situation as a result of COVID-19.
Spontaneous thing where people are upset. That's one whole part of this, and it's part of a general movement, I think, that we're seeing around the world of the ultra-right asserting itself and using the money of the millionaires to do it.
The so-called Freedom Convoy protests started with truckers protesting COVID-19 vaccine or quarantine mandate. It then broadened to include people opposing all coronavirus-related restrictions announced by the Trudeau government. The protest has attracted the support of thousands of Canadians, even some who are fully vaccinated. They say all COVID-19 preventive measures must be dropped. The protests have drawn support from groups from the U.S.
Having is a right-wing attack on all kinds of things, because one of the demands of the people in Canada was that Trudeau should resign, and the other was that the western part of the country should secede. So, you know, these are not just little political things. So you have, in Canada in particular, the implementation of a very conservative right-wing agenda. And everybody agrees on that, especially the right-wing who's doing it. So this isn't just some kind of, you know, spontaneous thing where people are upset.
Canadian authorities have said about half of the funding for the protests has come from U.S. supporters. Toronto Dominion Bank last week froze two personal bank accounts that received $1.4 million Canadian dollars for the protests. In the western Canadian province of Alberta, police have broke up a group that was armed and prepared to use violence. The protests that have hindered traffic at border crossings have impacted more than $500 million in commerce each day.
I think that what happened was that the automobile companies complained. You know, there's production shut down, millions of dollars lost. And it was pretty clear that that was very unpopular. And he waited long enough for the economy to be heard and people to be heard and said, enough's enough. And I think the balance of force has changed a bit because of that.
Truckers and their supporters have gathered in the capital, Ottawa, since January 29th to rally against mask mandates, lockdowns, restrictions on gatherings, and other COVID-19 preventive measures. Some downtown Ottawa businesses have had to shut down temporarily. There have been reports of rock throwing, property damage, harassment, and even hate crimes.
The Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood made headlines once again on Sunday. Clashes broke out between Israeli forces and Palestinian residents in the area after far-right Jewish lawmaker Itamar Ben-Gvir opened a parliamentary office in Sheikh Jarrah. Tens of Palestinians were injured in the Israeli crackdown. The Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Expatriates condemned Ben-Gvir's step as a provocative and escalating move that threatens to ignite violence. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry says the Israeli regime is fully and directly responsible for the escalation in the occupied Al-Quds and potentially dire consequences of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. It added that the failure of the international community and the United Nations Security Council to take necessary measures to compel Israel to stop its occupation of Al-Quds encourages the occupying power to forge ahead with its colonial Judaization projects in the Holy City.
Well, that was expected, and he did it largely as a publicity stunt and to raise his profile within Zionist politics in Israel, and of course to, you know, to shove it in the face of the Palestinian Christian and Arab or Muslim community that lives in the area. But it was designed for controversy. But it definitely is a political stunt, and it's designed to increase tensions in the area. And this is most unfortunate and illegal, and mostly condemned around the world as you know, sort of an attempt to Judaize the area and to drive out the Palestinians.
Earlier, the Hamas resistance movement had issued a strongly worded message of warning to the Israeli regime and settlers after the latter renewed their attacks on Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. Mohammed Hamadeh, a spokesman for the Gaza-based movement, said the attack amounts to a clear violation and that Israel was playing with fire. Israel's attempts to evict families from the Flashpoint Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood resulted in an 11-day war between Gaza-based Palestinian resistance groups and Israel back in May. Israel is evicting Palestinians to make way for its settlement-building activities. This is while under international law, all Israeli settlements are deemed illegal. The United Nations Security Council has condemned Israel's settlement activities in the occupied territories in several resolutions. Al-Quds remains at the heart of the decades-long conflict, with Palestinians insisting that East al-Quds, illegally occupied by Israel since 1967, must serve as the capital of a Palestinian state. In the meantime, the Al-Aqsa Mosque has had enormous significance throughout the years. In the year 2000, an Israeli official's visit to the holy site provoked a Palestinian uprising known as the Second Intifada. Observers believe any escalation of violence or provocative action by Israeli forces in the holy city could serve as a prelude to a new intifada.
It is part of the Judaization of East Jerusalem, and it's an attempt by Zionists to drive the Christian and Muslim Arabs out of the city and increase the Jewish population.
Emboldened by former U.S. President Donald Trump's unqualified support, Tel Aviv expanded its illegal activities against the people of Palestine. Many were expecting a turn of events when Trump left office, but the regime continues to carry out its acts of aggression in the absence of any meaningful action from the international community.
In the limelight.
The National Endowment for Democracy can claim it is in the business of democracy promotion. In reality, it does anything but that unless democracy is entirely synonymous with elite U.S. interest. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Alan McLeod, journalist. This article is published under the heading Documents reveal U.S. government spent $22 million promoting anti-Russia narrative in Ukraine and abroad. Stay tuned for the first part of this article, please. Amid soaring tensions with Russia, the United States is spending a fortune on foreign interference campaigns in Ukraine. Washington's regime change arm, the National Endowment for Democracy, that is NED, has spent $22.4 million on operations inside the country since 2014, when democratically elected President Viktor Yanukovych was overthrown and replaced by a successor government handpicked by the United States. Those operations included propping up and training pro-Western political parties, funding pliant media organizations, and subsidizing massive privatization drives that benefit foreign multinational corporations, all in an effort to secure U.S. control over the country that NED President Carl Gershman called the biggest prize in Europe. The National Endowment for Democracy was set up in 1983 by the Reagan administration after a series of public scandals had seriously undermined both the credibility and the public image of the CIA. That the organization was established and continues to function as a cutout group doing much of the agency's dirtiest work is not in question. It would be terrible for the democratic groups around the world to be seen as subsidized by the CIA, Gershman himself said, explaining its creation. A lot of what we do today was done covertly 25 years ago by the CIA, NED co-founder Alan Weinstein told the Washington Post in 1991. Since its inception, NED has been a driving force behind many of the most prominent uprisings and coups around the world. The organization currently has 40 active projects in Belarus, all with the goal of removing President Alexander Lukashenko from office. Last year, the country was engulfed by nationwide protests that made worldwide headlines. NED's senior Europe program officer, Nina Okninavo, boasted that her agency was involved in the uprising. we don't think that this movement that is so impressive and so inspiring came out of nowhere, that it just happened overnight, she said, noting that Ned had made a modest but significant contribution to the protest. The 2021 protest movement in Cuba was also led by Ned-financed operatives, with the organization's own documents showing how it had for years been infiltrating the Cuban art and music scene in an attempt to turn popular culture against the communist government. Ultimately, the movement failed. Ned is almost entirely funded by U.S. Congress and is staffed largely by ex-national security state leaders. Its current president is Damon Wilson, former special assistant to President George W. Bush and senior director for European affairs at the National Security Council. Other top officials pepper Ned's board of directors, including current CIA director William J. Burns, current Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs and 2014 Ukrainian Maidan Revolution mastermind Victoria Nuland, as well as veteran national security official Elliot Abrams, infamous for his role in supplying weapons to far-right death squads in Central America and his attempts to overthrow the government of Venezuela. Despite this, Ned still insists that it is a private, non-profit, non-governmental organization. One key reason for this designation is that its private nature means that its affairs do not fall under the same legal scrutiny as those of government organizations like the CIA. It is harder to acquire documents under the Freedom of Information Act, for example, meaning that the group's actions remain shrouded in secrecy. Studying the Ned Grants database reveals that the organization has approved 334 separate grants to Ukraine, a country the group's 2019 annual report identified as its top priority owing to its size and importance for the Europe region. The report notes that Ned is focused on countering foreign influence, particularly disinformation and corrosive capital. Of the European nations, only Russia itself has been the target of more Ned money. That is $37.7 million to Ukraine's $22.4 million. Ned is rather hazy about where its money is going, with the only clues being brief one-paragraph descriptions, really longer than 75 words, full of boilerplate rhetoric. Yet, scrutinizing even the vague project outlines, it becomes clear that Ned has two major objectives in Ukraine. Number one, pushing through a mass privatization of the country's state-owned businesses. And number two, building up political parties that will represent elite U.S. interests. Ned has also been key in building up pro-U.S. political forces in Ukraine, notably awarding the National Democratic Institute for International Affairs, NDI, nearly $2.2 million towards this endeavor. Congress established NDI in tandem with Ned, and NDI, like its sister organization, claims to be a non-governmental organization, despite being affiliated with the Democratic Party. Its chairperson is Madeleine Albright, Secretary of State under the Clinton administration. One $595,000 grant describes how NDI will help political parties develop into inclusive national movements and will assist parties in the development of inclusive internal communication and decision-making procedures, and conduct public opinion research and trainings to help parties better understand and respond to citizens, including those outside of the traditional geographical basis of support. A less charitable interpretation of the grant would be that the U.S. government is taking over the political direction and organization of Ukrainian political parties, molding them as they see fit. In tandem, with the support of political blocs also comes the grooming of young political and social activists who NET hopes will become the leaders of tomorrow. To this end, it has given at least $385,000 to the European Institute for Democracy in Warsaw in order to, in its words, support a new generation of political leaders in Ukraine by conducting training courses for their hand-picked protege, flying them out of the country to provide lessons in election campaigning, women empowerment, effective governing, and crisis management, among other skills. The point, of course, is to develop a cadre of pro-Western neoliberal thought leaders who will ally themselves to the United States and its vision for Ukraine. Left unstated in all, this is that the United States is deciding who exactly this new generation of leaders comprises. Another key focus for NED is to establish and support pro-Western media outlets and NGOs that backed both the 2014 overthrow of Yanukovych and the new government's privatization agenda. This is all couched as promoting independent media, but in reality, it is creating a network largely dependent on and answerable to Washington. One example of this is the Ukraine Crisis Media Center, which consistently publishes studies about Russia's efforts to distort facts and scare stories about an impending Russian invasion, while inviting the British ambassador to give talks at its headquarters. Ukraine Crisis describes its vision of Ukraine as an outpost of freedom and democratic development in Eastern Europe and an integral part of the West. Ukraine Crisis is directly funded by a number of different U.S. governmental organizations, as well as by NATO and the governments of Germany, Canada, the UK, Norway, Sweden, Poland, Finland, and the Netherlands. Most of the media organizations NET funds also maintain English language versions of their websites. This is because many of these groups are used to influence Western audiences as well as individuals inside the target country, Ukraine.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host, Musa al-Bahadali, and you are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems and other issues parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. As usual, all of the answers provided in this program are based upon the Holy Quran and upon the narrations of the Prophet and of the household of the Prophet, peace be upon them all, supplemented by scientific data and facts. Joining us in the studio is our dear friend and Islamic researcher, Sayyid Abdullah al-Musawi from the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, I welcome you and assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalamu wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sayyid. Today, dear listeners, we will be discussing mistake number 13 parents make when raising their children, and that is bargaining with your children and accepting their conditions. For example, when you want them to do a chore, you tell them that you must clean your rooms. They will come with all sorts of conditions and bargain with you, basically. It becomes rather than a opportunity for teaching, it becomes a bargaining session. It becomes a trade. Dear Sayyid, what should we do in such a scenario?
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد. One of the most common mistakes that parents make when it comes to raising the children or bringing the children, we see that at some stage of their life as children, they start to come and try to imply rules and conditions on their parents, that I will do this if you do this for me, and I will not do this if you don't do that for me. So they are the one who are putting the conditions on us. And what happened is that you see a lot of parents, sadly, because they want to keep their children quiet and happy, they submit and succumb to the conditions of their children. Look, I won't study if you don't do this for me. I won't read if you don't do this for me.
Right.
I won't do this if you don't do that for me. And, you know, because children, they have the capacity to be arrogant and to be, they have the capacity to fight for longer and nag for longer. You see a lot of parents, they give up.
Right.
And they say, fine.
They're very stubborn.
Fine. Right. Have it your way. Now, what happens here? We are subconsciously teaching the child in his brain that the concept of you cannot give unless you take is the only method. So the child thinks now, he's thinking, okay, I can get wherever I want by just, you know, demanding it from my parents. By them, if they ask me for something, I'm going to demand something which I want.
And it becomes a give and take situation.
Yeah. So, for example, the child wants something and he knows his mother is going to ask him to come and eat. He's like, okay, this is my opportunity. This is my time. She says, come eat. He's like, I'll come eat if you let me play. And the mother says, obviously, she might argue this and that. And she gives up. Okay, you play for half an hour. And then she sees it comes to a stage where the parents, they ask the children and the children will deny them that request.
All right. And with that, let's go ahead and take a quick break.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back to your listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing mistake number 13 some parents make when raising their children, and that being bargaining with their children. Dear Sayyid, please continue the discussion.
Therefore, we see some kids, and they learn from a young age that life is about giving and taking.
Right.
Okay, there's nothing just giving others. So this idea, this concept that he only can give something unless he gets, it gets embedded into him at a young age and obviously by his parents. And that indicates to us that the parents who have this method and this methodology in dealing with the children, that they have in fact lost control over the child. That they are the ones who are under the mercy of the child.
He's no longer submissive.
Vice versa. Of course he's not being submissive. So a lot of parents, they don't understand that. Until it gets to a stage where the child will bluntly deny them anything they ask for. And they find themselves completely hopeless in trying to deal with the children in this case. So because we already have taught our children that life is about giving and taking. And this is just a very selfish way to bring children.
It's very selfish.
Exactly. And that's why we see, for example, the Muslim world, alhamdulillah, we teach our children from a young age to be able to give charity and help others and help those who are in need. But right. In a secular system, where they teach you that you only give if you take something in return.
Right. If there's no benefit for you, no personal gain, not do whatever you are trying to do.
Exactly. So this is happening. And you can see that this concept grows with them from a young age. So as parents, this is something that we have to be very mindful of because it will happen somewhere during a life's childhood. It could happen at an early stage, or it could happen in the middle of his childhood, or it could happen in his teenage years.
And then the damage is done for the rest of their life.
Yeah, so you have to be very mindful that this will come up somewhere around the child's age if you are not being very careful in dealing with such a child. Right. For example, if you teach him, or if you are at least lenient with him at some stage of his childhood that is okay to give and take, then we have a problem.
Say, just a question regarding this. One of the forms of worshiping Allah is actually this very form of worship, the bargainer's worship, the trader's worship, when you worship in return for getting access to paradise. Some might say, well, isn't this just the same thing then? We can use this mentality of the child, this whole you bargain, you get some in return for something that you give, and then apply it to make them perhaps worship Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Well, obviously, the concept is quite different here. When it comes to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, it's Him who is setting the laws and rules. He says, you pray for me, I give you heaven, not we. So if I'm saying to Allah, oh Allah, I will only pray for you if you give me heaven. No, that's something that He already said. So when I pray to Allah, I pray because I want to get the prize that He set, which is what? Heaven.
You're and following His rules that
exactly
He said.
So I'm following His rules, not my rules.
Right. That's the difference.
The concept that you're talking about, which is with children, will only apply if we're saying to Allah, oh Allah, I will not pray for you today if you don't give me 10 kilos of gold tomorrow.
Right.
Yeah.
And with that anecdote, let's go ahead and take a quick break.
Ya muqiyal khayrat, ya muqiyal khayrat.
Regarding the sixth verse of Surah At-Tahrim, the 66th surah of the Holy Quran, that is, O you who have faith, save yourselves and your families from a fire. Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam said, save your families from fire by enjoining them to do good and forbidding them from evil deeds.
Ya muqiyal khayrat,
welcome back, dear listeners. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing mistake number 13 some parents make when raising their children, and that is bargaining with their children and meeting their children's conditions. Dear Sayyid, please pick up where you left off.
Therefore, if we want to have a solution to this problem that we are facing with our children, it is very important that we understand that when it comes to doing things, there are things that are necessary to be done and things that we can set
non-negotiable
a price and negotiate with the kids with.
Right.
So, for example, when it comes to eating and drinking or sleeping or studying, these things should not be bargained with.
We should not let a child bargain with. Right.
Now, the same concept with these things that are necessary, we can ourselves set, for example, what we call encouragements to. So, for example, I say to them, if you study, if you pray, I would give you such and such. So, like you said before the break, the question with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, it is necessary for us to be done. As in a way to get us to do it, He says there's a reward for you in doing it.
Right.
You pay charity, I will give you this. You pray, I'll give you this. You do salat al-layl,
I'll give
you this.
But isn't this also a bargain, dear Sayyid?
No. So there's no bargain here. This is incentive.
An incentive
to make you move towards doing something. If you don't want to do it, you can. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, if you don't want to pray salat al-layl, it's your choice. But you're losing. If you pray Salat al-Layl, there's an incentive for it in all the ibadat, whether it is wajib, because when the wajibat, obviously, because this it's absolutely vital to ourselves, so Allah says it must be done, and also having it, that fact that it's done, I will also give you a reward. So that reward also...
Right. So this encouragement, you said, it shouldn't be a negotiating chip that the parents use when they want to make their children do something.
No, this is... Yeah, so this is, in a way, it's correct. But what we're trying to say here is the fact that when it comes to the important, necessary things...
Right.
These ones you should not bargain with. For example, we have to make it clear that when it comes to bargaining... We're saying that the child sets the condition. He says, I will only sleep if you let me watch a movie. I will only sleep if you give me the phone for an hour. I will only study if you give me this.
These things are necessary.
Right. So what happens, like you said, it's the parents who, for example, if they want to give incentive, then they can.
Right.
Okay? There's no bargaining here. So, for example, I see my child praying. I come and encourage him. I give him an incentive. He understands that what he got is for him achieving something, not for him setting a condition on me that I will not do it unless you give me.
Right.
It's different. Now, if the child gets more encouraged to do more salah so he could get more from you, that's a different thing. That's a good thing.
Right.
Now,
but he cannot, again, demand
He cannot
something.
Demand.
That's
the key here.
Right.
He should not let them demand anything for any action, at least if the action is necessary and important, such as, like I said, eating or sleeping or doing your studies or even doing your ibadah, your salah, your siyam.
Right.
We should not make it a point where the child could bargain with us. I'll go pray, but first let me watch this movie.
Right.
First let me do this. We say to them, no, there's nothing here. So, but as a parent, if I want to give something from my own for an action that's already done, then there's no problem there.
And with that, we will have to end today's program because we are out of time. I thank the dear Sayyid for his insightful knowledge. I also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. If our dear listeners have any suggestions, feedback, or some comments, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. Alternatively, you can also visit our website, parstoday.com. You can also find us on various social media websites, such as on Twitter and Instagram, under the call handle of Call of Islam Radio. Thank you for tuning in.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
By supporting the Saudis and UAE, President Biden not only has abandoned promises he made after first taking office in January 2021, but is also fueling the war and aggravating Yemen's retaliation against its aggressors, says Ahmad Abdul Karim, journalist, in an article published under the heading, As U.S. renews support for Saudi war in Yemen, civilian death toll nearly doubles. Stay tuned for more. Two parallel but very different meetings took place recently, one in search of peace, the other to plan more war. In Oman's capital, Muscat, an official delegation headed by Ansarullah met with Omani and European officials to negotiate de-escalation and humanitarian assistance in Yemen. Meanwhile, the United States and the Saudi-led coalition held meetings to plan a ground escalation in Sana'a and Hajjaj province in Yemen's southeast to coincide with airstrikes against residential neighborhoods in other cities throughout the north, which have killed and injured dozens of people and caused extensive damage to property and infrastructure. In the wake of Joe Biden's pledge of support to the Saudi king during a call and a corroborating statement by CENTCOM commander General Kenneth F. McKenzie Jr., the Saudis wasted little time translating this support into ground action. The oil-rich country, supported by American and British military planners and expats and a large number of mercenaries, has imposed an oppressive siege on Haradh, a strategic Yemeni city in Hajjaj province. Situated near the Yemen-Saudi border, Haradh lies emptied of people and largely destroyed by Saudi airstrikes and artillery bombardment. The crippling siege is designed to pave the way for a ground invasion of the city, which oversees the Red Sea port of Mehdi in Yemen's far northwestern reaches. The city was once relatively prosperous, benefiting from smuggling and cross-border trade. When the Saudis announced their military operation, dozens of people have been killed, and hundreds of families have fled their homes as Saudi bombs devastate the city and the roads leading into and out of it. Haradh was not the only target of Saudi violence. U.S.-backed coalition forces dropped hundreds of tons of bombs on densely populated cities including Sana'a, Al-Hudaydah, Hajja, Sa'de, Ma'rib, and Al-Jawf. In Sana'a, where Saudi forces uncharacteristically gave a 72-hour evacuation notice to government facilities, warplanes razed the Ministry of Telecommunications and Information Technology, destroying communication systems and triggering an internet blackout. U.S.-backed coalition forces also bombed several areas of the capital around the ministry. The Yemeni parliament said that the bombing of the telecommunications sector was intended to isolate Yemen from the rest of the world, adding that Saudi Arabia and UAE aim to carry out more massacres and war crimes in defiance of the international community. Since May 2019, when Ansarullah government unveiled National Vision to heal, rebuild, and modernize their war-torn nation, Yemeni government facilities and ministries have succeeded in establishing relative stability, managing a population of more than 15 million people, and keeping the exchange rate at 600 riyals per US dollar. Now, Saudi Arabia claims that government facilities are being used for military purposes. Ansarullah has denied the claims and invited foreign media to visit all government facilities, adding that the bombings will not break the people's will. Even during the 72-hour evacuation period, Saudi airstrikes pounded the streets leading to the airport and the most important entrances to the capital. Oil-rich Ma'rib and Al-Jaf also came under Saudi attack, while a citizen was killed and three wounded in the Al-Muslab area in Al-Tuhita district in Al-Hudaydah. In the past week alone, Saudi Arabia has violated the Al-Hudaydah ceasefire agreement 1,426 times. Saudi airstrikes also targeted Sa'deh province, where witnesses told Min Press News that many people, including African immigrants in Al-Raq area, in Al-Munib border district, were killed by Saudi shelling. In addition, the districts of Araza, Shada, and Kitaf were subjected to all-out air raids, the most violent since a January 22nd Saudi coalition attack on a Yemeni civilian prison. Amid the escalation, President Biden held a call with Saudi King Salman bin Abdul Aziz, where he reaffirmed the United States' commitment to back the Saudi-led coalition. On February 8, CENTCOM Commander McKenzie told UAE's state-owned WAM news agency that the United States is working with the UAE and other regional and global partners to develop more effective solutions to stop Yemeni drone attacks even before they are launched, sparking concerns that the U.S.-backed Saudi coalition could launch even more preemptive attacks against Yemen under the pretext of stopping the attacks on Saudi and UAE targets. Recently, a shipment of F-22 fighter jets arrived in UAE from the United States. Save the Children has described January as the bloodiest month since 2018 for Yemen, stating that one Yemeni civilian was either killed or wounded every hour during the last month. Between January 6 and February 2, more than 220 adults and 15 children were killed, and over 354 adults and 30 children were injured as well, Save the Children said in a recent report. In the January 22nd Saudi coalition attack on the Sa'deh city remand prison, UAE warplanes dropped precision-guided bombs made by U.S. weapons manufacturer Raytheon, the latest piece in the border web of evidence of the use of U.S.-manufactured weapons in incidents that could amount to war crimes, according to Amnesty International. Since November 2021, the Biden administration has approved multiple arms deals with Saudi Arabia, including a $650 million agreement to sell Raytheon missiles to the kingdom and a $28 million contract for U.S. maintenance of the kingdom's aircraft. In December, the administration stated that it remains committed to the proposed sale of $23 billion in F-35 aircraft, MQ-9B drones, and munitions to the UAE. These weapons bring death and destruction to civilians in Yemen, but are less effective against Yemen's army and Ansarullah, which have gradually grown stronger, leaving Riyadh and Abu Dhabi bogged down in the country and looking for more support. U.S.-made weapons are not the only cause of extensive destruction and piling up of civilian victims in the war-torn country. The U.S.'s aggressive diplomatic stance has also taken a significant toll. Washington's diplomatic efforts, paired with a seemingly endless supply of the Persian Gulf oil money, have brought about the dissolution